content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. We're reading this week from the March 22nd, 2019 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing shows Uncle Sam. He's in his bed. He's waking up. He's got a grumpy look on his face. His feet are sticking out from underneath the covers. And in his left hand, he is smashing an alarm clock. The title is Too Early to Rise, The Growing Backlash Against Changing the Clocks Twice a Year. And I think we get that article on the Talking Points page. But as usual, we'll start with the main stories. Boeing's 737 MAX 8 grounded worldwide. What happened? President Trump bowed to mounting pressure this week to ground the Boeing 737 MAX 8 after a second deadly crash in 5 months killed 157 in Ethiopia and persuaded regulators and carriers worldwide to ban the planes from their airspace. After the Ethiopia disaster, in which at least 8 Americans died, the Federal Aviation Administration initially said it found no systemic issues with the MAX 8 and thus no basis for a ban. But the FAA and Trump, who had been personally lobbied by Boeing's CEO to keep the plane in the air, reversed course after more than 50 nations, including the European Union, Canada, and China, had grounded the plane over concerns that it was difficult to control during takeoff. "The safety of the American people and all people is our paramount concern," Trump said. Trump's decision came after Canada's transportation minister said a review of satellite tracking data by his country's experts found similarities between Sunday's crash of an Ethiopian Airlines jet and a Lion Air crash in Indonesia's Java Sea in October, which killed 189. It was also revealed this week that at least 5 pilots from U.S. Airlines had lodged complaints with the FAA about how the MAX 8 performed in flight since October. The MAX 8 first flew commercially in 2017, and some 350 are registered, including Southwest Airlines 34 and American Airlines 24. United Airlines has 14 MAX 9s, which were also grounded. Boeing, which has 5,000 MAX series planes on order, or two-thirds of its future deliveries, said it agreed with the decision to ground the planes out of an abundance of caution. What the editorial said. "Let's wait for the investigators to reach their conclusions before deciding the plane was at fault," said the Chicago Sun-Times. Yes, both crashes exhibit similarities. The Ethiopian crash came just 6 minutes after takeoff, the Lion Air flight 12. But there are also differences. Lion Air has been previously cited for improper plane maintenance and pilot training, and some witnesses said they saw smoke coming from the plane before it crashed. And don't forget that 350 planes of the same model have been flying all around the world for 2 years without incident. While the jury is still out, said the San Jose Mercury News, the FAA had no real choice but to err on the side of caution. People's lives are at stake. Boeing, meanwhile, sent mixed signals, insisting that the plane is safe, but then promising to install new flight control software on MAX 8s. In other words, there's nothing wrong with our planes, but we want to fix them anyhow. What the columnist said. "This disaster is rooted in a bad business decision by Boeing," said Jeff Wise in Slate.com. "To stay competitive with a new fuel-efficient Airbus jet, Boeing faced a design choice. design a next generation 737 from scratch, or revise the legacy version, a vastly cheaper option. Boeing chose the latter. But to accommodate better engines, it had to move the point where the plane attaches to the wing, resulting in a dangerous tendency for the MAX 8 to pitch up and possibly stall. Boeing compensated by added software that pitches the nose down if it senses upward drift. Clearly, the engineers used automation to paper over the aircraft's flaws. These crashes could be the result. The FAA's slowness to respond to this crisis is not surprising, said Heather Timmons in QZ.com. The Trump administration is hostile to regulation, and acting officials occupy the FAA's top three posts, including Administrator Dan Elwell, a former American Airlines executive and airline industry lobbyist. Trump just proposed massive cuts to FAA staff. The agency simply isn't under optimal conditions to deal with a big issue like two Boeing crashes. It's also worth noting that Boeing's influence in Washington is mammoth, said Melanie Zanona and Brianna Gucciolo in Politico.com. The company has 153,000 workers and employs 24 in-house lobbyists and nearly 20 lobbying firms. It spent $15 million plus dollars on D.C. lobbying last year, more than any other U.S. company except for Google and AT&T. Oh, and Trump's new Secretary of Defense, Patrick Shanahan, spent 31 years at Boeing and has been reported to lavish praise on the company's products at meetings and criticize those of its competitors. Does that explain why the U.S. was the last advanced nation in the world to ground the MAX 8 and 9? The controversy of the week, Representative Omar, do Democrats have an anti-Semitism problem? I have a new hobby, said Matthew Continetti in the Washington Free Beacon, collecting the excuses Democrats make for Ilhan Omar, the freshman Minnesota congresswoman trying to mainstream anti-Semitic rhetoric within the Democratic Party. Before her election, Omar accused Israel of having hypnotized the world, presumably with the sinister mind control powers that anti-Semites for centuries have attributed to Jews. She then dredged up the myth of outsized Jewish financial influence, claiming that U.S. support for Israel was all about the Benjamins, $100 bills. Omar apologized, claiming not to know the history of these ugly tropes, but then dredged up the ugliest of all, the dual loyalty slur, accusing Israel supporters of demanding allegiance to a foreign country. Rather than denouncing Omar, Democrats circled the wagon, said Seth Mandel in the Washington Post. They accused her critics of racism and Islamophobia. Omar is a black Muslim, while House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said the Somali-born Omar has a different experience in the use of words. In the end, Omar's only punishment was a toothless House resolution condemning bigotry in all its forms, including both anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. Even for Washington, the cynicism was breathtaking. These howls of right-wing outrage ring hollow, said James Downey, also in the Post. Where was this principled opposition to anti-Semitism when GOP Representative Kevin McCarthy accused Jewish billionaires George Soros and Michael Bloomberg of trying to buy the midterm election? Or when President Trump repeatedly used the word globalist, long a favorite of anti-Semitic conspiracy theorists who think international Jewry controls the world? Or when he claimed there were some very fine people in the white supremacist mob that marched on Charlottesville chanting, Jews, you will not replace us. Omar's ill-chosen words were offensive, said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times. But the reaction was worse. Led by the repugnant white nationalist in the Oval Office, Republicans gleefully attacked the first hijab-wearing congresswoman because vilifying Muslims plays to their base. As a Jew, I find Omar's language reckless, but also think that there's nothing inherently anti-Semitic about questioning the U.S.'s unblinking support for the increasingly right-wing and oppressive Israeli government. Omar needs to do better, but right now there's still only one political party in America that is a safe place for hate. Not if Omar gets her way, said Brett Stevens, also in the Times. I believe she knows exactly what she's doing, trying to remake the Democratic Party into a safe haven for far leftists who hate Israel. If this sounds paranoid, look at Britain, where under the leadership of Omar's kindred spirit, Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour Party has become such a hotbed of anti-Semitism that British Jews are now fleeing that party in droves. Omar's critics are right about her crude and freighted language, said Andrew Sullivan in NYMag.com. But the fact is we now give $3.8 billion annually in aid to Israel, far more per capita than to any other country. And yet we are expected to consent to anything and everything Israel wants. In the Trump administration, that has included withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal, a move of our embassy to Jerusalem, a surge in West Bank settlements, and an intensification of the abuse of Palestinians. This is a grotesque distortion of U.S. foreign policy, and it deserves a much wider debate. Is it possible to have one without being accused of engaging in any anti-Semitic tropes at all? And let's see what nuggets we have in our good week, bad week segment. It was a good week for fornicators. After the Utah State Legislature this week belatedly voted to repeal the law criminalizing fornication, in which unmarried person voluntarily engages in sexual intercourse with another. It was a good week for integrity. After the ex-wife of a man who just won $273 million in the Mega Millions lottery announced that she doesn't want him back or a cent of his winnings, despite supporting him for years. He's not appealing to me all of a sudden because he has this money, said Eileen Murray, 53. I have morals. And it was a good week for efficiency, with President Trump's denial that he referred to Apple CEO Tim Cook as Tim Apple during a recent White House meeting. When a video showed that Trump had, in fact, said Tim Apple, Trump tweeted that it was an easy way to save time and words. But it was a bad week for restaurant menus after the mayor of Bologna, Italy, launched a campaign to convince the world that the meat-based pasta sauce known globally as Bolognese has no historical connection to his city. Spaghetti Bolognese doesn't actually exist, said Mayor Virginio Mirola, age 64. Bologna, he said, did create tagliatelle and tortellini. It was a bad week for jingle bells, with the arrest of Clayton Lucas, 25, of Pittsburgh, who allegedly tried to choke his Lyft driver from the back seat because the man wouldn't stop singing out-of-season Christmas songs. And finally, it was a bad week for biblical literalism, after a South African diver was swept, Jonah-like, into the mouth of a feeding bride's whale. Rainer Schimpf, 51, says, it got dark, I felt some pressure on my hip, and I instantly knew a whale had grabbed me. Fortunately, the filter-feeding whale spit the intruder out of its baleen. And a boring but important item here, U.S. lets private schools hire religious groups. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos said this week that she would cease enforcing a law that bars religious groups from providing federally funded services to private schools, continuing her department's push to expand protections for faith-based organizations. Federal law entitles private schools to funding for some services that public schools get, especially if they benefit children from low-income households or English language learners. Private schools were not allowed to hire religious organizations to provide those services. DeVos, however, contends that that runs counter to a 2017 Supreme Court decision, which held that denying public funds to improve the safety of church playgrounds was odious to the Constitution. The title of our briefing page article this week is The 5G Revolution. Phone companies have made big promises for their new 5G networks. Will the next generation of wireless live up to the hype? What is 5G? Since the first commercial wireless network went live in 1986, we built a new one about every decade. The first generation network, 1G, allowed voice calls over bulky brick phones. The second gave us digital texting. The mid-2000s ushered in mobile internet connectivity. The next decade brought 4G and broadband video streaming. This year, all four major U.S. mobile carriers are rolling out the next generation of service. The dramatically faster connectivity they promised with 5G could unlock an array of technologies, from autonomous cars that share traffic data to immersive virtual reality games. It's not just a phone technology. It could replace wired broadband in the home and allow for billions of other connected devices. Chris Lane, a telecom analyst at Sanford C. Bernstein, thinks it will turn cities smart in much the same way electricity illuminated them. Everything will be connected, he says, and the central nervous system of these smart cities will be your 5G network. What's the key technology? Cellular phones are essentially two-way radios, transmitting voice and data as radio waves. 5G uses higher frequencies than can that can transmit vastly more data, allowing for blazing speeds. Today's 4G signals use waves that are a few inches to a foot and a half long. The waves for 5G are the size of raindrops, permitting smaller antenna to transmit them. Today's cell towers might support a dozen antenna, but 5G towers can house 100, allowing networks to support 1,000 more devices per meter than 4G. The flip side is that the antenna need to be placed closer together too. In cities such as Denver that are getting an early rollout of 5G, that's already spurring conflict as unsightly new towers spring up on residential streets. Just how fast will it be? Experts envision millions of these small cells blanketing cities and providing dense, ultra-reliable networks that cut latency, the time it takes a signal to travel to a tower and onward to the internet, from 50 milliseconds to as little as one. Meanwhile, mobile 5G download speeds could reach 10 gigabits per second, or enough to reduce download times for a typical movie from 6 minutes to 20 seconds. but don't expect these speeds right away. The telecom maker Qualcomm expects initial median 5G speeds of 1.4 gigabits per second, or about 20 times faster than today's 4G, and around 1.4 times faster than the top home broadband speeds now offered by cable. That's not the speed you'll get this year or next, however. Initial speeds on AT&T's networks have been measured at about four times as fast as 5G connection. Eventually, though, 5G's speed and low latency could let phones offload computing tasks to powerful cloud computers, extending battery life and easing the race for more powerful and expensive phones. Is it only about speed? Yes and no. Speed matters. The chipmaker Intel projects that in the first 10 years of 5G networks, 90% of the use will come from video, which certainly benefits from every improvement in download speed. But the hope is that the combination of more data and close to zero latency could open the way to new kinds of applications. Self-driving cars and trucks are high on the list because 5G connectivity could bring online not only the vehicles, but also the roads and cityscapes they navigate. Drones will be able to send video and mapping data to be analyzed in real time. Mobile 5G is the focus right now, but in time the services could also reshape the internet access market, creating serious competition for cable companies' home broadband services. When is 5G coming? America's largest wireless carriers, Verizon, T-Mobile, AT&T, and Sprint, have announced plans to roll out 5G this year, with nationwide service available in 2020. Already, AT&T offers 5G hotspots in 12 cities, and Verizon a 5G home-branded Wi-Fi service in four. That said, coverage is going to be fairly sparse this year, said Mark Hung, an analyst at Gartner. Though within the next 3 to 4 years, 5G coverage is going to be fairly ubiquitous. But it might not ever reach everyone. Steve Barry, a Washington lobbyist for smaller wireless companies, said the costly build-out required to achieve 5G will turn an existing digital divide between rural and urban America into a digital divide on steroids. Is there reason for skepticism? Yes. Some experts don't see strong 5G in the U.S. until 2023 and say paying an extra $200 to $300 for a 5G-enabled phone will be wasted money until then. And some think the predictions of instantaneous transmission of vast amounts of data will turn out to be hype. Linley Group analyst Linley Gwinnap points out that the promised latency of 1 millisecond covers only the connection to the nearest smart cell or tower, and that downloading data from the internet will take significantly longer. For most normal things you're doing on the phone, it's not going to go to the cloud, said Gwinnap. He wonders what happens when the 5G-enabled self-driving car hits a cellular dead zone. Mobile ecosystem analyst Mark Lowenstein advises that a dose of reality is needed, along with patience and a long view. Moving into the columns, we'll start with why Pelosi opposes impeachment. Nancy Pelosi's anti-impeachment stand makes sense, said Ed Kilgore. The House Speaker angered some of her Democratic colleagues this week when she said that impeachment proceedings would be so divisive to the country that unless there's something so compelling and overwhelming and bipartisan, I don't think we should go down that path. Now, Pelosi didn't rule out the House impeaching Trump if Special Counsel Robert Mueller or Democratic committee investigations revealed crimes or wrongdoing so damaging that even Republicans abandoned him. Pelosi was merely acknowledging that the GOP is unlikely to turn on Trump no matter what comes out. A recent Morning Consult poll found that 86% of Republicans oppose initiating impeachment proceedings despite ample evidence of corruption and crimes. This is a very different and more right-wing Republican Party than the one that turned on Richard Nixon during Watergate. Trump has convinced his supporters that politics is nothing but partisan warfare and that any impeachment effort would be a coup d'etat. So why launch an impeachment effort that's doomed to fail and may just energize the Republican base? Pelosi thinks it's better to let all the dirt come out and then run against a badly damaged Trump in 2020. This is a How They See Us column from Europe, funding the far right. American billionaires are trying to influence the May elections for the European Parliament, said Damien Leloup in Le Monde from France. Not content with spreading misinformation in the U.S. through the far right Breitbart News, hedge fund billionaire Robert Mercer, 72, and his daughter Rebecca, 45, also fund the Gatestone Institute, a neoconservative think tank focused on Europe. The Institute frequently warns of a coming jihadist takeover of the continent. The Mercers also fund The Rebel, a Canadian far-right site that actively campaigned for Brexit and routinely depicts a Europe on the verge of collapse, especially because of immigration. In 2017, a rebel writer disseminated Macron leaks, emails stolen from the presidential election campaign of Emmanuel Macron, and published 2 days before the second round of the French vote. The ploy failed to derail Macron's victory, but it's feared that similar email dumps could affect the European Parliament vote. Nor are the Mercers alone. U.S. manufacturing billionaire Robert Shillman has poured money into far-right causes across Europe, including support for anti-Islam Dutch politician Geert Wilders. These billionaires want to tip the balance in a 27-nation election that is shaping up to be an epic battle for Europe's future, said Christian Makarian in L'Express from France. On one side are establishment liberals, best represented by Macron and German Chancellor Angela Merkel, who want a stronger, more integrated EU and who emphasize civil liberties, tolerance, and human rights. On the other side are authoritarian, anti-immigrant, nationalist forces, as personified by Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban. He has put forward an explosive European plan based on civilization vision that exploits the defense of Christian identity. His camp, which includes Poland's ruling Law and Justice Party and Italy's League, want a weaker EU. The explicit goal is to destroy European cohesion from within, said Ingrid Steiner-Gashi and Irene Meyer-Kalani in the Courier from Austria. That's what Steve Bannon, former chief strategist for U.S. President Donald Trump, boasted last year. The beating heart of the globalist project is in Brussels, Bannon said. If I drive the stake through the vampire, the whole thing will start to dissipate. Backed by unknown financiers, possibly the Mercers, Bannon is setting up a gladiator school at an old Italian monastery where would-be populist activists will be trained in the dark arts of spreading misinformation and hate. So far, the plan is still just a plan. But the EU fears Bannon's influence through fake news and social media propaganda. Yet Bannon has far less influence than he pretends, said Daniel DePetris in The Spectator from the UK. Many EU countries bar political parties from receiving foreign help, and some far-right parties are concerned about the optics of taking direction from an American. The Alternative for Germany party actually seemed offended at the very idea. Understandable given Trump's massive unpopularity in Europe. If populists do gain in May, Europeans will only have themselves to blame, not Americans. And we'll finish with an international column from Tanzania. A thriving society needs a free press. This newspaper is back after having been banned for a week. And what have we learned? Asked the citizen. For daring to report on the slide of the Tanzanian shilling against the U.S. dollar, our print and web presences were censored by the government as punishment. Our reporters had interviewed bankers and currency traders to source our story, but the government held that official information, such as exchange rates, must come only from the Bank of Tanzania. The suspension order also cited seditious intent in our reporting on comments by U.S. Senator Bob Menendez, who asked the Trump administration to defend civil liberties in Tanzania and push back against the tide of anti-democratic actions. All we can say is this. The citizen has always striven to provide true, fair, accurate, and balanced reporting. We believe that only a well-informed society can creatively and actively contribute toward building a dynamic, vibrant economy. The government of President John Magufuli aims to transform Tanzania from a mostly agricultural to a semi-industrialized middle-income economy by 2025, and we support that goal. To get there, though, information is key. The people need to be informed of government policies. That's what we will continue to do. And the last word, our in-depth article, titled this week, When You Become Allergic to Meat, a tick-borne syndrome that triggers an allergy to meat and animal products is spreading throughout the southeastern U.S. and the world, said journalist Marin McKenna. It has doctors baffled and worried. It is early morning in early summer, and I am tracing my way through the woods of central North Carolina, steering cautiously around S-curves and braking hard when what looks like a small rise turns into a narrow bridge. I am on my way to meet Tammy McGraw, who lives with her husband and the youngest of their kids in a sprawling development of old trees and wide lawns just south of Chapel Hill. Before I reach her, McGraw emails, she wants to feed me when I get there. Would you like to try emu, she asks, or perhaps some duck? These are not normal breakfast offerings, but for years, nothing about McGraw's life has been normal. She cannot eat beef or pork, or drink milk or eat cheese, or snack on gelatin-containing dessert without feeling her throat close and her blood pressure drop. Wearing a wool sweater raises hives on her skin. Inhaling the fumes of bacon sizzling on a stove will knock her to the ground. Everywhere she goes, she carries an array of tablets that can beat back an allergy attack and an auto-injecting EpiPen that can jolt her system out of anaphylactic shock. McGraw is allergic to the meat of mammals and everything else that comes from them. Dairy products, woolen fiber, gelatin from their hooves, char from their bones. This syndrome affects some thousands of people in the United States and an uncertain but likely larger number worldwide. And after a decade of research, scientists have begun to understand what causes it. It's brought on by the bite of a tick, picked up on a hike or brushed against in a garden, or hitchhiking on the fur of a pet that was roaming outside. The illness, which generally goes by the name alpha-gal allergy, after the component of meat that triggers it, is a trial that McGraw and her family are still learning to cope with. In much the same way, medicine is grappling with it too. Allergies occur when our immune systems perceive something that ought to be familiar as foreign. For scientists, alpha-gal is forcing a remapping of basic tenets of immunology. How allergies occur, how they are triggered, whom they put in danger, and when. For those affected, alpha-gal is transforming the landscapes they live in, turning the reliable comforts of home, the plants in their gardens, the food on their plates, into an uncertain terrain of risk. In her memory, McGraw's symptoms began after 2010. That was the year she and her husband, Tom, a retired surgeon, spied a housing bargain in North Carolina in a development next to a nature reserve. The leafy spread of streams and woodland pockets was everything she wanted in a home. She didn't realize that it offered everything that deer and birds and rodents, the main hosts of ticks, want as well. She remembers one tick that attached to her scalp. Raising such a welt, the spot was red for months afterwards, and a swarm of baby ticks that climbed her legs and had to be scrubbed off in a hot bath laced with bleach. Unpredictably, at odd intervals, she began to get dizzy and sick. I have unexplained allergic reactions, and I'd break out in hives and my blood pressure would go crazy, she told me. The necklines of all her t-shirts were stretched because she tugged at them to relieve the feeling she couldn't take a deep breath. She trekked to an array of doctors who diagnosed her with asthma or early menopause or a tumor in her pituitary gland. They prescribed antibiotics and inhalers and steroids. They sent her for MRI scans, pulmonary function tests, echocardiograms of her heart. Nothing yielded a result. Looking back, she realizes she missed the clues as to the source of her problem. She would feel short of breath and need to visit an urgent care clinic on Saturdays, which always started in her household with a big breakfast of eggs and sausage. Then a close friend had a scary episode going for a run, arriving home and passing out on the hot concrete of her driveway. Once she had recovered, McGraw quizzed her. Her friend said, "They thought I got stung by a bee while I was running, but now they think maybe I have a red meat allergy." McGraw remembers her first reaction was, "That's crazy." Her second was, "Maybe I have that too." She Googled and then she asked her doctor to order a little-known blood test that would show if her immune system was reacting to a component of mammal meat. The result was so strongly positive that her doctor called her at home to tell her to step away from the stove. The surprising story of how doctors in the U.S. discovered alpha-gal allergy begins with a cancer drug called cetuximab, which came onto the market in 2004. Cetuximab is a protein grown in a cell taken from mice. For any new drug, there are likely to be few people who react badly to it, and that was true for cetuximab. It is, in its earliest trials, one or two of every 100 cancer patients who got it infused into their veins had a hypersensitivity reaction. Their blood pressure dropped. They had difficulty breathing. But there was an aberration. In clinics in North Carolina and Tennessee, 25 of 88 recipients were hypersensitive to the drug, which with some so sick they needed emergency shots of epinephrine and hospitalization. At about the same time, a patient who got cetuximab in a cancer clinic in Bentonville, Arkansas, collapsed and died after the first dose. Alpha-gal is familiar to many scientists because it is responsible for an enduring disappointment. Its ability to trigger intense immune reactions is the reason that organs taken from animals have never successfully been transplanted into people. The puzzle was why the drug recipients were reacting to it. To have an allergic reaction, someone needs to have been primed with a prior exposure to a substance. But the trial recipients who reacted badly were all on their first dose of cetuximab. A team of allergy specialists led by Dr. Thomas Platts Mills at the University of Virginia scrutinized the patients and their families for anything that could explain the problem. The reactions appeared regional. Patients in Arkansas and North Carolina and Tennessee experienced the hypersensitivity, but ones in Boston and Northern California did not. Then Dr. Christine Chung, a Nashville researcher recruited to the team, stumbled onto an intriguing clue. Almost one in five of the patients enrolled at a cancer clinic at her hospital had high levels of IgE antibodies linked to alpha-gal allergy. But when she checked those patients' neighbors, the same almost one in five of those antibodies, too. The alpha-gal reaction, it turned out, had nothing to do with cancer, says Platts Mill. It had everything to do with rural Tennessee. The question then became, what in rural Tennessee could trigger a reaction like this? A clue emerged. Rocky Mountain spotted fever is transmitted by the bite of a tick. Amblyomma americanum, one of the most common ticks in the southeastern U.S. It's known as the Lone Star tick for a blotch of white on the back of the female's body. The researchers wondered if the mystery reaction shared a footprint with a tick-caused disease. Could ticks be linked to the reactions too? It was an intriguing hypothesis and was reinforced by a new set of patients who came trickling into Platts Mills Clinic at about the same time. They were all adults, and that was odd to start with, because allergies tend to show up in childhood. They'd never had an allergic reaction before, but now they were experiencing allergy symptoms, swelling, hives, and in the worst cases, anaphylactic shock. They too had high levels of IgE antibodies to alpha gel. None of them, though, were cancer patients. They told the physicians that they had no proof of what was causing their reactions, but more than a few of them sensed it had something to do with eating meat. Dr. Scott Commons, a postgraduate fellow in Platts Mills' group, took it upon himself to phone every new patient to ask whether they'd ever suffered a tick bite. I think 94.6% of them answered affirmatively, he said. And the other few percent would say, you know, I'm outdoors all the time. I can't remember an actual tick that was attached, but I know I'd get bites. There has been so little research into alpha-gal allergy that scientists can't agree on exactly what stage of the bite starts victims' sensitization. It is possible that a fragment of a previous blood meal from a mouse, bird, or deer lingers in the tick's guts and works its way up through the mouth and into its human victim. It's also possible that some still unidentified compound in tick saliva is chemically close enough to alpha-gal to produce the same effect. One aspect of its epidemiology is becoming clear, though. The allergy isn't caused only by the Lone Star tick, nor did it begin in the U.S. In 1987, Dr. Cheryl Van Noonan was confronted with a puzzle. The head of the allergy department at a regional hospital outside Sydney, Van Noonan saw a patient who kept waking up in the middle of the night in the grip of some profound reaction. The only potential allergen that returned a positive result was meat. Then a few more such patients came her way. By 2003, she had seen at least 70, all apparently affected by meat they had eaten a few hours before. And invariably, these people would say to me, I haven't been bitten by a bee or a wasp, but I've had lots of tick bites, Van Noonan recalls. Van Noonan wrote up a description of 25 meat allergic patients whose reactions she had confirmed with a skin prick test. All but two had had severe skin reactions to a tick bite. More than half had suffered severe anaphylaxis. That abstract formed the basis of a talk she gave later that year to an Australian medical association. It took until 2009 for the Virginia Group to catch up to Van Noonen's work, after they had already published their first alert. The crucial detail in Van Noonen's research that Platts Mills' team didn't know about wasn't just that her cases were earlier than the first round of American ones, it was that they were caused by bites from a different tick, Ixodes holocycles, called the paralysis tick. Alpha-gal allergy was not just an odd occurrence in one part of the U.S., it had occurred in the opposite hemisphere, making it possible that it was a global problem. And so it has proved. Alpha-gal reactions linked to tick bites have now been found in the UK, France, Spain, Germany, Italy, Switzerland, Japan, South Korea, Sweden, Norway, Panama, Brazil, the Ivory Coast, and South Africa. These cases trace back to at least six additional tick species. Wherever ticks bite people, everywhere other than the Arctic and Antarctic, alpha-gal allergy has been recorded. In Belgium, patients reacted badly to a drug produced in rabbit cells. In the Italian Alps, men who went hunting in the forest were more at risk than women who stayed in their village. In Germany, the most reactive food was a traditional delicacy, pork kidneys. In Sweden, it was moose. Van Noonen herself has now seen more than 1,200 patients. The next busiest clinic, about 350, she says. Those cases all have occurred in two decades. As in America, the surge leaves Van Noonen mystified as to what the cause might be. She reasons that the rise cannot be due to something in her patients. Neither genetic nor epigenetic change could occur so quickly. It has to be environmental. Last August, Commons gave a talk on alpha-gal allergy at the International Conference on Emerging Infectious Diseases, a conference held every two or so years and sponsored by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, that often surfaces the earliest signals of illnesses that are destined to become big problems. The CDC's director of foodborne illness was in the audience. So was its director of vector-borne diseases, the department that deals with ticks. Afterward, they both zoomed up to ask him questions. I kind of had the impression that this was just a weird small thing, Dr. Lyle Peterson, the vector-borne director told him. But this thing seems like kind of a big deal. With the NIH and CDC paying attention, research into alpha-gal might be reaching a threshold at which isolated investigations coalesce into answers. For the patients, those answers can't come soon enough. This was adapted from an article that originally appeared in Mosaic. That's found online at mosaicscience.com. And we're over on the talking points page, starting with the article that the cover drawing referred to. Daylight saving time, the sleepy backlash. Human beings can do nothing to change the rotation of the earth and the sun, said Kirk Johnson in the New York Times. And yet, every year, bless our hearts, we try. So once again this week, millions of irritated, sleep-robbed Americans groped blindly in the pre-dawn dark for the snooze button, then repeated the confounding ritual of resetting the clocks on at least a half dozen appliances. This leaping, clock-shifting confusion began in 1918, when the country first instituted daylight saving time, DST, to save energy during World War I. But in a growing nationwide backlash, many people are saying it's time for time to be left alone. At least 31 states are considering legislation that would end the biannual changing of clocks. And last week, bills were introduced in the Senate and House to permanently keep the country on daylight saving time. Even President Trump has jumped on the bandwagon, tweeting, "Make daylight saving time permanent is okay with me." Changing the clocks is not such a big deal, said Michael Hiltzik in the Los Angeles Times. That extra cup of coffee you need for a day or two every spring is a small price to pay for the next 8 months of more sunshine. Springing forward borrows sunlight from the pre-dawn hours, when most people are still in bed or getting ready for work, and adds it to our most active period of the day. This gives the average 9-to-5 worker a bit more time to enjoy life under natural light. As popular mechanics put it, DST is a life hack to force our lives to fit the natural world in a more sensible way. There might be a middle ground, said Mark Joseph Stern in Slate.com. As the Senate and House bills suggest, the answer is not to end DST. It is to extend DST year-round. Standard time is the villain, responsible for the crime of early sunsets each November. Permanent DST would end the clock fiddling and make all our lives better, said Steve Caladrillo in MarketWatch.com. Studies suggest that an extra hour of evening sunlight would diminish fatal U.S. traffic accidents, reduce crime by 20%, save energy, and boost commerce and recreation. So let's set the clocks forward forever and never switch them back. Trump's children, fair game for investigators? House Democrats have eagerly gone to war with President Trump, said Andrew Desiderio and John Bresenahan in Politico.com. But there's one target they're skittish of hitting too hard, his children. It would be impossible for sprawling new probes into Trump's political and business careers to ignore Donald Jr., Eric, Ivanka, and her husband, Jared Kushner, particularly since all but Eric work in the White House. Yet some Democrats fear that investigating the Trump children would create sympathy for the president. That's why some on the House Oversight Committee hope to leave the kids' crimes to federal prosecutors while they take on the president. Recent revelations make that difficult. Trump reportedly overrode aides' objections to grant Jared and Ivanka top-secret security clearance, and Donald Jr. signed checks reimbursing Michael Cohen for illegal hush payments from the campaign. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi thinks family is fair game, saying, "Whoever falls into the net, falls into the net." What an apt metaphor, said Michael Goodwin in NYPost.com. The House is embarking on a ridiculous fishing expedition to smear Trump, and going after his children in business is way out of bounds. Some Democrats apparently believe Trump's election and conduct give them license to eliminate all restrictions on congressional oversight. It's true that putting a member of the president's family in the investigatory hot seat is a delicate business, said the New York Times in an editorial. But the public needs to know why the CIA didn't want to give Kushner a security clearance, among other things. Trump supporters will no doubt cry foul, said Tina Nguyen in VanityFair.com. In certain circles, the first family is revered like royalty, and Trump's three eldest children collectively have about 12 million Twitter followers. No one in Trump's orbit spends more time taunting the president's critics and pursuers than Donald Jr., said Greg Sargent in WashingtonPost.com. He seems to be daring the fates to come at him, confident he will skirt any consequences. It was he, remember, who replied, "I love it," when Russians offered dirt on Hillary Clinton. When House investigators recently requested documents from Eric Trump, he called the inquiry a joke. Trump's children seem to think they're untouchable. Whether that hubris ultimately brings them down remains to be seen. And we've got time for a few shorter notes. Democrats have chosen Milwaukee, Wisconsin as the site for their 2020 national convention. Party organizers hope to win back the once Democratic-leaning state, which Hillary Clinton lost in 2016 after holding no campaign events there. About 61% of the nation's 10.7 million undocumented immigrants live in just 20 major metropolitan areas. The largest undocumented immigrant populations are in New York City, 1.1 million, Los Angeles, 925,000, Houston, 500,000, and Dallas-Fort Worth, 475,000. More than 1,400 cities and towns across the U.S. have had a newspaper close over the past 15 years. As a result, many Americans no longer have journalists serving as watchdogs on their local public officials, chronicling high school and amateur sports, or honoring the lives of local residents in obituaries. So far, the Trump administration's travel ban has blocked 9,500 family members of U.S. citizens from entering the country, including 5,500 children and nearly 4,000 spouses. The ban primarily affects five Muslim-majority countries: Syria, Iran, Yemen, Somalia, and Libya. And we'll finish with a quote from art critic John Ruskin, who says, "I find penguins at present the only comfort in life. One feels everything in the world so sympathetically ridiculous. One can't even be angry when one looks at a penguin." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments, give us a call, 919-832-5138.